Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots.
What does that matter to a bloated millionaire fat cat like you? In other financial news, stock markets rose both domestically and abroad today after the announcement of stronger-than-expected earnings by several high-tech companies, but dipped again, reacting to reports that Nicholas Van Orten had sneezed. Are you going to spend the rest of the evening prying at that clown's mouth?
I don't...
It's frustrating for me if you don't pay attention.
What is this?
This is your game, Nicholas, and welcome to it. I'm here to let you in on a few ground rules.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Podshots. I'm your host, Eric Williams. For this episode, we are discussing the 1997 film, The Game. Written by John Brancato and Michael Ferris, the film was directed by David Fincher and stars Michael Douglas, Deborah Kara Unger, and Sean Penn. Here to discuss the film with me is returning guest, Mr. Will Pfeiffer.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. So as Will regaled me with his drink of choice before we started recording, why don't you share with the listeners what it is that you're having to have?
I'm having a Coke Zero cherry flavored, I guess it'd be called. I'm living the high life here.
That's right. I thought for a minute we were going to be simpatico. I have a cup of coffee, but I do have a little Bailey's in there.
Oh, nice.
So it's going to be a long night. So I figured I better make an enjoyable long night out of it.
That's right.
Yeah. So with that, we're ready to kick off our discussion of the 1997 film, The Game.
What do you get for the man who has everything? Everything.
Everything. Happy birthday, sir. Thank you, Maggie.
I don't like her. So what brings you to town, Conrad? Everything all right?
October 12th. Nikki's birthday. This is for you.
Consumer Recreation Services.
Call that number.
Why?
They make your life fun.
What are you selling?
It's a game.
A game?
Specifically tailored for each participant.
John, chapter 9, verse 25. Whereas once I was blind, now I can see. Now I can see.
One day your game begins. You either love it or hate it.
Are you going to spend the rest of the evening prying at that clown's mouth?
Mr. Van Orten, is everything all right?
Ah, Mr. Van Orten.
Have we met?
I believe so.
Why are you following me? Find out about a company called Consumer Recreation Services.
They won't stop, Nick.
He's in on it.
I paid the bill. I paid him more to make it stop.
I need the police. You're going to break into my house. I'm being poisoned by a bunch of depraved children.
They're trying to kill me.
Who's behind this? Who did this to me? Why?
This is all the game.
Right now, I am extremely dangerous.
You're behind the whole thing, aren't you? No!
They make your life fun.
And normally here I would put in the IMDb plot synopsis, but they are very poor for this film.
Yes.
So instead I went over to Amazon and got the synopsis from over there, and it goes as follows. There are no rules in, quote, the game, and that will make life very difficult for Nicholas Van Orten, a successful businessman who is always in control. Van Orten lives a well-ordered life, until an unexpected birthday gift from his brother destroys it all. Like it or not, Nicholas has been enrolled in a game, a profound life experience that begins quietly but soon erupts in a rush of devastating events. Van Orton has to win this deadly game or lose control of everything in his life. Okay, so that's the plot synopsis. I'm not 100% sure as to actually how we came to this movie. I think we were just throwing around some different possibilities. But tell me about your history with this film.
Well, I was the first. I remember seeing Fincher's film Seven, which I think came out in 1995. We saw that in the theater, and that was before. I mean, Fincher had done Alien 3, and he had done, you know, some Madonna videos and commercials and stuff, but he definitely wasn't, you know, a marquee director at this point. And I can distinctly remember a group of all the people I work with at the newspaper I used to work at all went to see Seven on opening weekend just because, oh, it's some new thriller, blah, blah, blah. And so we watch it, and I remember all of us sitting, we went out for drinks or food afterwards, sitting around the table just staring at each other, not quite sure what we had seen, because I mean, Seven is, it's a pretty intense experience, especially if you go in knowing nothing about what you're going to see. And this was opening night, so none of us knew it. So from that moment, you know, I was a big fan of Fincher. So when this movie came out 2 years later, this was his next film after Seven, I went to see it, probably opening weekend with my then girlfriend, now wife, Amy. And, you know, Seven, in case you haven't seen it, I'm sure most people have, is it's extremely dark. I mean, it's a dark movie, both figuratively and literally, and the ending is just brutal. Mm-hmm. And so going into the game, which, like the plot said, you know, it's about a rich guy and he's put through the ringer in this mysterious game, you expect something really dark. And one of the things I liked about it, one of the things that surprised me, is at its heart, it's not nearly as dark as you think it's going to be when all is said and done. And it's a lot more of sort of a Hitchcock, not a caper film, but almost, the title of the game is really appropriate, because it really almost, the movie itself is like a game to a puzzle that you kind of have to solve, or you have solved as you watch it.
Yeah, and the credits do a good job of that too. That's something that I hadn't seen this in a while, but you know, you watch it and it is white type, and then all of the credits, you know, disintegrate into puzzle pieces.
Right.
And then they do the same. It's the same motif for the cover, the DVD art, or the IMDb box art, or whatever you want to, however you want to call it. But yeah, I found that to be true watching it this time as well, where it was. I didn't go to the theater to see this, but I saw it not long after Seven. I think, you know, and looking back on that, isn't that crazy that, you know, a guy that hadn't really done much and had been so unproven has Morgan Freeman, Brad Pitt, and a whole host of people on his film.
Yeah, because, I mean, that was, yeah, I mean, and this is when Brad Pitt, you know, Morgan Freeman had been doing a lot of stuff, but this is when Brad Pitt was sort of, you know, he was, you know, on the becoming the movie star that he, you know, is and really was in the 90s. So yeah, I mean, and you know, no spoilers for Seven. Well, I mean, I guess it is a spoiler, but you also had Kevin Spacey.
Sure. Yeah. You know,
right around Usual Suspects time in Seven too.
Yeah. Because in modern day, it would be like if some nobody had, I guess either like a Chris Pine or a Chris Pratt or a Chris, the Chris's apparently, or,
any Chris, of the Chris's.
Or like a Hemsworth or something, you know,
right.
It'd be like somebody, or like Chris Evans, Jesus,
right, all the Chris's.
And you know, somebody like that
too, because, Alien 3, which was Fincher's, the only movie he made before Seven. I mean, it was a difficult shoot by all accounts. You know, the studio re-edited after he did it. I mean, this is not the sort of start you would think would lead to something like Seven, and lead to him now being, you know, he's one of the directors, you know, not, he's like popular director, you know, tends to be nominated, but also he's one of those directors that when his movie comes out, film fans are like, I gotta see that. I gotta see, you know, they don't care about the plot or who's in it, but they're like, I gotta see what Fincher's done.
Yeah, it's almost like, I kind of liken him in a way, in the way that he's popular and popular with the critics. Is it's a little Christopher Nolan like,
right? Right.
You know, it's like, yeah, he can produce a blockbuster, but he's going to have an interesting film.
Right, and he works with, you know, I mean, he's not some little, you know, he's, I mean, it's almost a bad example because Wes Anderson, you know, at this point works with big stars, but he's not that kind of a director. He's a big Hollywood, big budget, you know, big movie director. He's not some little indie guy, and he still makes very interesting movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I guess getting to my history was, you know, like I said, I didn't see it in the theater. I did see Seven first, and I think I saw, yeah, I think I came to this late because I believe I saw Panic Room second.
Oh, okay.
And was like, wow, this guy, everything is at night and very dark.
Yeah.
You know? And was like, and little did I know that was a thing.
Yeah, because, I mean, look at the other movies we haven't even mentioned. Fight Club, rather dark. Mm-hmm. A lot of it takes place at night. Zodiac, rather dark. Social Network, rather dark. Gone Girl, rather dark. Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I guess Benjamin Button, maybe his lightest film? Maybe? I don't know.
It's his lightest in that it's the one I didn't see.
Oh, I've seen them all, and that's definitely the one that I have no desire to return to. Although there's great things in it. I mean, it's just, I don't know. It didn't hold together completely, but there are great moments in that movie.
Sure. That's what I've heard. It's an interesting watch.
It's worth watching if you've never seen it. I mean, yeah. There's stuff in it. Kate Blanchett, she's great in it.
Well, with that being said, what was your initial reaction? And then on this rewatch, has your opinion changed on the film?
I think because the game is so, you know, it's you know, it's the kind of movie where there's a lot of twists, there's a lot of turns. You don't know sort of what's real within the context of the movie and what's a trick being played on Michael Douglas's character. So my initial reaction was, you know, kind of, I would describe as entertained confusion. I mean, I didn't know what was going on. You're trying to piece it together, but it's a pretty fast moving movie. But I remember being very entertained. I think Michael Douglas, you know, sometimes he takes a bad rap for playing the same sort of character, but if yes. you want like kind of a rich bastard, he's your guy. I mean, he plays that role really well.
He is excellent at what he does.
Yeah.
That's why I like him in Wonder Boys. I think he's interesting in that.
He's great in Wonder Boys. And, you know, one of my guilty pleasures, but this movie definitely, some people can't stand it, some people like it, but I will watch Wall Street anytime it's on. I mean, I just think as corny and over the top as it is, it's just, the story always pulls me in. And as Gordon Gekko, I mean, there's a reason that performance is so iconic. He really plays it well.
Yeah, the original Wall Street.
Yeah.
Because they didn't make a new one, right?
Well, they did. They made a sequel and by the way, I saw that in the theater.
Did you really?
I heard
that was better than what I expected it to be.
There, you know, it's, I like the original Wall Street, and because it so perfectly encapsulates that 80s kind of a thing.
Oh.
And this movie, there are flashes of that. I mean, the thing about the Wall Street sequel is literally one of the highlights is Charlie Sheen's, like, his one brief appearance in it. It really works. Despite all the water under the bridge of Charlie Sheen, what he's become, it really works when you see him as Bud Fox again. It's a nice little scene.
Interesting. Interesting. So going back to the game, it is kind of a puzzle. It is kind of you're not paying attention too much other than the plot. So
right.
when you rewatched it, what did you make of it when you knew how it was going to end?
Well, then, you know, like a movie like this, when you rewatch it, then you search for, you know, you look for clues, you look to see, you know, sort of where the patterns are. But you can also, you know, I appreciated his performance a lot more. I appreciated Sean Penn's performance. Deborah Carr Unger, you know, she gives a nice performance. She's someone who never, she's been in a lot of things. She never really kind of broke through, but she's good. And she's, you know, she's definitely the secondary lead, and she kind of has to play it where you're never quite sure whose side she's on and how deeply she's involved.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of good character work. There's, and like all Fincher movies, I mean, it looks great. It all takes place in San Francisco. I mean, his home is beautifully realized. All the scenes in the city, the lighting, the scene where he goes into the water and the taxi cab. I mean,
Oh, yes.
You know, Fincher at his worst could not shoot a scene that wasn't striking. And this is it's a really good looking movie.
Yeah. That, I mean, even with Alien 3.
Right, right, right.
It's dark, but it is interesting looking.
And I think that, you know, that's his background of, you know, those Madonna, you know, he shot Vogue. I mean, that's a great looking video and, you know, and those commercials he shot, I mean, the guy, you know, he's got an eye. That's why he's, you know, so in demand, I think.
Sure, sure. So when you rewatched it, did it live up to expectations? Or
yeah, it did. I mean, I think you know, a movie like this, you watch it the first time, and I liked it, but your mind starts going like, well, that could never happen. Well, that's, you know, how did they know he was going to do that? Because there's a lot of that in this movie. I mean, you have to suspend your disbelief. But the second time, you can, I really appreciated, you know, I forgot about that stuff because it's a movie and it knows what it's doing. And I tried to sort, you know, I appreciated how the puzzle fit together and how everything, you know, reflected on each other and how all these little bits. And there's a scene in the movie, and this is when I saw the movie the first time in the theater, I was thinking to myself, I gotta see this again on video because I wanna see this specific scene again. And what it is in the game that, Van Orton, Michael Douglas's character gets caught up in, there's people, a lot of people are actors, you know, who meet cops, he doesn't know if they're real, or there's people on the street, maybe they're involved, maybe they're not. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene where he, at the end, he gets near sort of figuring out the game. He goes to the headquarters of where it's being planned or
The lunch room, yes.
Yeah, he goes into the lunch room, and in a quick shot, you see virtually every background character you've already seen in the movie. It's a great, like, sort of blow your mind kind of scene.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, that is easily, well, maybe outside of the final reveal, but
right.
That's one of the most interesting scenes that I'd seen in a while when I watched this. Cause I was like, oh my God. You know, just, it's like a real life Truman Show sort of situation.
Right.
And yeah, so I think that, you know, when I first watched it, I really enjoyed it. And it was a film that I kind of, I don't know, let marinate for a while.
Mm-hmm,
because I think this is probably only the third time I've seen it. And it had been such a while since I had watched it, and I had so many movies in between to where I was like, okay, well, I know what's going to happen. You know, and this is a spoiler-filled discussion, so we will be talking about the end. And so I know that, you know, it's all a game and everything's fine and whatever. But I forgot how it got to that point. You know, I remembered the roof. I remembered the lunchroom scene. I remembered, you know, like a lot of the drowning and the near fatalities.
Right.
But I forgot about, you know, it being the TV that's talking to him.
Yeah, Daniel Shore on the TV, yeah.
Yeah, and so I forgot about a lot of those sort of things. So I guess getting into, and I really enjoyed it, but one of the things that I thought was a little less successful than I remembered is I feel like the script is so concerned with the twist and the the mechanics of it all, of how can we make this seem somewhat believable, that they lose the beginning, maybe half hour is sort of lost in exposition.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean,
it's just very surface at the beginning.
It's definitely a movie. I mean, though the whole point of the movie is they're going to take his character and sort of, you know, redeem him, for lack of a better word. It's definitely a movie that's more plot driven than anything else. I mean, the plot is the engine driving this movie, not the characters, you know. I mean, it's definitely getting from point A to point B to point C. So that's a good point.
Well, they do the things like, well, as you know, my father was 48 when he killed himself.
Yeah. I mean, there's that. Yeah, there's some of the dialogue. You just wish they could tweak it just a little.
And I was like, yeah. You know, and when you see that the script was originally, it was a spec script.
Mm-hmm.
And that it had been sold and been in development for a while. I was like, okay, well, that makes sense. You know, it's not a true sort of Hollywood polish. Hadn't really been put on it as much as it probably would be today.
Right. I mean, it was reworked some before they did it. But yeah, you're right. It definitely, you know, you can see why this script sold, because the premise, you know, boom, you're like, well, that's, you know, that's a movie. I mean, you can see why the studio picked up that script.
Yeah. It almost makes me think of, what's the very poorly reviewed Jesse Eisenberg film? I believe it's Now You See Me or The Magic.
That thing's playing on HBO nonstop now, and it's not good.
Yeah, I believe that was the sort of thing there where it's like, okay, here's the premise. They're going to be magicians, and they're going to escape, and they're like Robin Hood but magicians, or you know, whatever the movie's even right. about.
That's yeah, that's it.
You know, and so it's like, oh, done. Write it.
Right, write it, and then you know, and yeah, and that boy, that's a script that could have used it several. But
so yeah, I do think that's
a good point. Yeah, with the game, it's definitely that kind of script.
Yeah, so that was a little troubling. It wasn't anything where I was like, oh, I don't like this movie anymore because of this, or you know, it wasn't something that off putting. I do want to ask you about the home video part of it, because I think that is sort of sneaky in its effectiveness, in that it does give him a little bit of history, even though it's sort of plopped right in front of you, and it's there to try to avoid the exposition.
Yeah,
in some ways.
You mean the thing about his father's suicide?
Yeah, his father's suicide, where I wish that they could have maybe dropped that in a time or two more.
Right, because that really plays into the. I mean. You know, the spoilers that his father had committed suicide when he was 48
mm-hmm.
by jumping off the house.
By jumping off his house, which is a terrifying scene
yeah.
in his past when you see him in his robe and he's just standing up there and you only see it for a few frames.
Mm-hmm.
But you're and, like, oh my, like,
and,
what a horrible again, thing to walk into.
Oh yeah, and with Fincher, the thing is, it's so beautifully shot. It looks like an old, you know, home movie. You know, and yeah, you're right. It's not like a big close-up or anything, and it's much more eerie because of how it's shot.
Yeah, that's very well done. I always think that's really interesting when they sort of take the time to make the past look like the past
mm-hmm.
with the, you know, not just like putting it in sepia tone or something, but, you know, actually making it look like it.
I want to say that is Michael Douglas's brother playing his father.
Ooh, you know, I did... I had that pulled up just a minute ago. Because it definitely does look like him, right?
I think it is.
It is Nicholas's father. It is Charles Martinet.
Oh, why did I think
plays him?
His father. I thought his brother was involved in this somehow, but
and he appears to be a voice actor. He's in a lot of video games.
Oh, okay.
Holy smokes.
I was wrong. I don't know why. Cause, you know.
Well, you would think it would be because it looks very much like him. It
does. Yeah. Oh, well, that's surprising. Cause, you know, and I mean, Michael Douglas, obviously, son of Kirk Douglas. So, you know, there's a whole father, son, you know, I mean, there a lot of things playing. And I was just thinking of this, and this just struck me personally as almost kind of funny, but this movie came out in 97 when I was turning 30. And I thought, you know, I'm watching it like, oh, Michael Douglas, he's this old guy, you know, blah, blah, blah. Not old guy, but, you know, an older guy.
A mature
now,
guy, yeah.
Talking about it now, I will be turning 48 next summer, so I will be the age of Nicholas Van Orton.
So hopefully for your sake, you have a ranch-style home.
I do. I have one-story home.
There you go.
But I do have a younger brother.
Oh, there you are.
So he may get me involved in the game.
Hopefully his name's not Conrad.
It is not Conrad, no.
Yeah. So what, you know, you said that you had your IMDb pulled up earlier before we had started recording. What do you think of this top bit of the trivia here? It's Jodie Foster.
That's right.
Was originally signed on to play Connie, and she changed her mind and said wanted to be his daughter.
I was reading that. They talk about that in this book, this Dark Eye, The Films of David Fincher by James Swallow. And, and I think she wanted to play his daughter, but then I think Michael Douglas didn't want her to play his daughter because, you know, I guess it would make him seem that much older or something.
Yeah, he said that he didn't think it was right because there's 17 years age difference. Yeah.
Which is, you know, technically, I mean, that's old enough, but I, you know, you can kind of see the point.
Yeah. You know? And yeah, I think that's interesting. I mean, that would have been a completely different dynamic, though. I would have been like, oh my god, it's like the daddy's girl gone wrong.
Yeah. It works better, I think, with the brother for some reason.
Yeah, because it would have been so vindictive
mm-hmm.
to think that your daughter would be in, you know, I mean, it all ends well, but to think that she would put her dad through something like this.
Right, you're right. It somehow, it's less brutal if it's his brother. It comes more from a feeling of like he wanted to save his older brother, you know, something like that.
Yeah, especially because it's like, well, it's his daughter that he's raised, and I guess I could see to where it's like he could never make her make the right choices, or you know, whatever. I'm sure there's a a thing that you could string together to make it be like how Conrad is kind of the black sheep of the family, but I like it much better as the brothers.
I agree. Yeah.
They also said that Jeff Bridges was offered the role that Sean Penn took as well.
It works well with Sean Penn, I think, because he seems like a younger brother to Michael Douglas, and plus he seems like kind of a guy who's like been through some stuff, and
he's completely unlikable.
Right.
Right. Like, no matter the film that I see Sean Penn, I'm never warming up to him as a guy. He's just not a character where I was like, oh, I'm really rooting for you.
Not rooting for Sean.
No, never am. So, okay. So here's what else I have in my notes here is that, you know, this, what I think is interesting about the film is, what I'm watching at this time is I wrote that it's the kind of film that it has so much build up at the beginning of what the whole game is and what it's all about is that it better stick that landing, right? To where it better have the ending in mind and know where it's going and before you start building it up and causing all of this hype within the film.
Right.
Because you're talking, you know, he goes and he's rejected, he thinks, and he has the new members at the cigar and whiskey place he goes, and he sees that, and the TV starts talking to him, and it's just all of these different little build up.
And what I like what it does is where it does before it gets like into the big stuff, like he's in a taxi cab and it goes into the water and he may die, or you know, he's wakes up in a coffin in Mexico and all this. I love the little stuff at the beginning, like where he's rejected or where he's taking these tests to see if he's, you know, physically and mentally ready for the game. And then they just leave him like he's alone. You know, they leave him there and he doesn't know what's going on. And I like how all those little things build up, because then there's a scene where, like, you know, a pen in his pocket, you know, breaks. And you don't even really know if that's part of the game or if it's just something that happened. But the level of paranoia just keeps building and building.
Yeah, I do like that when he's in that theater by himself and he's seeing the different images. And I mean, we just recorded about a week ago or so our mutual friend Ben Teed and I recorded on Clockwork Orange.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was like, oh, okay, well, that's familiar. I've seen that. You know,
have you ever seen The Parallax View?
Yes.
Yeah, there's a scene in that, too, that I think they're echoing. And, you know, I think Fincher had both those movies in mind when he did those scenes.
Sure, I would think so. So we have all these different things that are happening to him. And, you know, he's showing a little bit of his frustration and what have you. And I do like the little insert after he's going and he's talking tough and he's trying to get the guy to sign his severance and he can't get the briefcase open.
Right, right.
And I do like that little insert where he's just freaking out and slamming the briefcase. And I think that it's a very good clue from right there that he's going to have a tough time throughout the end of the film. You know, because you're in your first 20 to 30 minutes and he's losing it already.
Right. Let me see if I can find this real quick, because I was reading. There's a quote from Fincher about the character and how he's in the game and sort of how his reaction to the game is. And he basically liked it because he thought the game was like a movie. But Michael Douglas is the lead character in this sort of movie/game, but he won't play the role right. He yells at people, you know, he has these tantrums, you know, he's like a real guy who's caught up in this, but he's not going along with it. He's like trying to solve the game a different way, or almost like break the game.
And
Michael Douglas is very believable doing that. I mean, that's, you know, he's great at those kind of scenes, I think.
Sure. It's post Fallen Down, right?
Right, right, right.
So it's not too far off from him just kind of breaking. So we have, you know, we have the whole Christine part where this time, you know, when I watched it originally, I'm like, oh, great, he's got someone to be with him.
Right.
You know, and I watch it this time and I'm like, oh, man, that is so clearly part of the deal.
Yeah, I mean, right for, and you know, if you watch it, what's interesting is, the way they introduce her character is she's in a scene and I pretty, in the restaurant, and she speaks, and the whole first scene she's in, you never even see her face.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you wouldn't even think like, oh, this is going to be a character later. You just think, oh, this is some extra and she's here. But then, you know, she spills on him and that's when it all starts.
Yeah, because she spills the tea first.
Mm-hmm.
I think when he's waiting for Conrad, and then she spills on him and ruins his shirt later.
Right.
Too. So, yeah. So I think, yeah, she's in there a couple of times, I think, before she's actually seen. So I think that that's, I think that that's interesting. I like that. But one of the things that I thought was weird, and again, it's a script thing, and this is when she's saying goodbye and she's leaving in the cab after their kind of crazy night.
Mm-hmm.
And she spilled the drink on him, and you know, they've gone up the elevator and all that. And so she says that they told her that they would give her $200, and she says, I said $300, they said $400. I said the cute guy in the flannel suit. Like, what kind of bargaining is that? You know, and that's again another one of the things where normally I would just breeze over, but I was like, wait a minute,
is that
they said two, you said three, and they said no, we'll give you four. It's like, what, this doesn't make any sense.
You know, the thing about a movie like this is you can almost, like, you know, if you're writing it and a mistake did get in, you could say, well, that's just part of the game.
Yeah, it's like, oh well, she was acting and she was ad-libbing in the game. And she was, you know, you could say anything. Like, oh, no, that's fine. That's whole part of the deal. It's just to show that there's cracks within the game, that it's not perfectly right. Smooth.
Well, there's that great scene where he goes supposedly to her house, her apartment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's there. And then he starts, there's like a, he smells something burning and he looks up and it's a price tag from a lamp that's dangling on a light bulb, and he realizes, like, everything's those price tags, or the books are all fake, or how, what, the drawers are all empty.
Yeah.
And so that's like, oh, he realizes something's up, but then you realize later, no, he was meant to realize that. I mean, it, like, you know, there's layers within layers within layers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. I do think, I mean, they don't show the bill, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
But to think of putting all those squibs in all of these abandoned apartments or whatever they are, and having all these guys run around with the little blood-filled squibs. And
on the off chance, because you think, like, okay, if they did this for this, well, what if he had run in this direction? Well, you have to set up for that contingency and this contingency. Yeah. I mean, it's what's his name? Sean Penn, at the end, he asked Michael Douglas if he'll help pay the bill, and it's implied that it's some insanely huge amount of money,
which it would
have to be.
Yeah, and I like how James Rebhorn.
James Rebhorn, yeah.
Yeah, I like how he said, well, I'm glad you jumped, or else I would have had to throw you off. Like, I think that's sort of thing is what I really appreciate about, you know, just a little line.
But it shows, like, they were thinking, because, you know, I've heard a lot of people complain about this, and they're like, it's so far-fetched. It could never work. And it's like, obviously it could never work. Mm-hmm. I think if you go in, once you realize what this movie's about, you kind of have to go with it if you're going to enjoy it at all.
Yeah.
But they show that they were thinking about, they're at least acknowledging that, yeah, we know it's a little far-fetched, but, you know.
Well, I mean, it's a Christmas Carol.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, I mean, it's essentially just Scrooge told via David Fincher.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I you mentioned James. I can never. Is it Rebhorn?
I think it's Rebhorn.
Rebhorn. He died this year, I think.
Mm.
He did, but he was on Homeland. I think he's perfect both in this, because, you know, he gives a nice little performance, but it's perfect casting too, because he's one of those classic guys that's in everything.
Yeah.
So of course he would be an actor who would be hired for this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it all fits. And then he's actually sort of how Michael Douglas kind of starts uncovering it, where he sees him on a commercial and then he tracks down who the real actor is. But then you realize, well, that was all a setup too.
Yeah, that's what's funny is it's like, well, how far reaching is it, or are they just like, okay, well, he may see him in a commercial, and if he finds him, because it always made me think, like, what if he just has a dummy cell phone?
Right.
You know, and he's just calling people that are either in on it or actors. Because he's making all these contacts, and half the time they're giving him good information when he's has it figured out. And then a lot of the time it's just things that are fed to him that are fed to him from the game.
Right, right. It's just, I mean, and that, but I love it like that. I mean, I like imagining this world where somebody could do this to someone. It just seems like so much fun, like to be working on it or to be caught up in it.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. You know, the part that is the one where I'm like, ooh, man, that's dangerous has to be the taxi.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because it's like, I'm just jumping out and he's just hopefully just going to go into this. I mean, I would imagine it's probably like sectioned off and it's some sort of pool for safety's sake, you know, making it seem real world here, Will.
Right.
If it was really going to happen, right? Like, what were the precautions that would have to be in place?
Isn't there a line somewhere about, there's like, oh, we had divers who were...
Yeah, we had divers, they said, yeah.
But still, I mean, and then you have to count on him not freaking out so much. He doesn't realize that, hey, that handle I got a couple scenes ago, well, let me open the door, you know, and...
Which I don't think that that's how it works, right? Isn't the pressure so great to where he wouldn't be able to do that?
That's what you can't open the door, you can't roll on the window.
Yeah, you can't open the door for sure. I guess he could be able to hand crank it open.
The window, yeah, I think you can.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
But it's so, you know, there was, I can't remember, this is several years ago, but they had a very brief, revival of the show Fantasy Island was on TV. It didn't even last the whole season, I don't think. I think Malcolm McDowell played Mr. Rourke. And I remember thinking, what they should do is don't put it on an island. Make all the fantasies like the game where they hire actors and you interact in the real world. And then there'd be like tension. Will they, you know, I just thought that would be cool. I just love this. I love the concept of this movie.
Just making the Truman Show an actual thing.
Exactly. But it set it in the real world. So, you know, they'd have to fake things and, you know, you wouldn't know if the fantasy had begun or not or that kind of thing.
Yeah, that would definitely be crazy.
It'd be tricky to write more than like three episodes of that, I realize.
Yeah, but it definitely would. Talk about your large writer room.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, we were talking earlier about Fincher and how everything is dark and that sort of thing. You know, everything's always wet, so you get that reflection. But I do think that his shots when he's in Mexico are very beautiful.
Oh, yeah, you know? Yeah.
So it's not like he's not capable of shooting during the day and having it look good or anything.
Well, even like, you know, Seven, the great thing about this, the visual structure of that movie is it starts off so dark, it's actually hard to see.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can see everything you need to, but at first you're like, is the movie really going to be this dark? And by the end, they're just out at that blinding... You know, in the desert where the, you know, Kevin Spacey makes his, you know, brings the box and everything. But yeah, he can shoot in any dark light. He can do it all.
Sure. And that's actually the only scene of the film, of the game when he's in Mexico and he's trying to find his way back. That's the only time it gets a little sleepy for me.
I agree.
Just because it's he's going to get back. You know, it's not going to end here.
No.
You know,
I agree. It does. It gets a little slow. Although I think you need, that's when you see him. He's like sort of, you know, he's been humbled at this.
Yes. Point. He's got to have his down Scrooge moment.
Yeah. He has to beg people for money. You know, I mean, he has to be the one who needs somebody else at that point.
Yeah. So I like that, you know, the basis of the film essentially is, you know, the main question is what do you give to the man who has everything? And I think that's what Conrad says when he's talking about the game itself. And clearly, you know, his life and his new mindset is the gift.
Exactly.
You know, because he, while he's very successful and he doesn't have really any friends, he doesn't have, you know, a spouse anymore or any children or anyone around him, really. He's just this Michael Douglas. You know, he's just the typical Michael Douglas character. And he doesn't, you know, he's very, Michael Douglas is always a guy where I always feel like he is, like a real sexual person.
Right.
Most of his films. And here he's very asexual.
Right, he just doesn't seem to care. I mean, yeah. Even, you know, I mean, you think about normally you'd see this movie, you would, okay, you got Michael Douglas, he's this rich guy, and then you have his co-stars, you know, Deborah Kerr Unger, this, you know, beautiful younger blonde, but there's a tiny bit of sexual tension, maybe? And then at the end, maybe they're going to have a drink? I mean, you know, that's really all it gets to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of like that because it's the film's it's not concerned by it.
Oh, I agree. I like it. I think that's very refreshing. It's, you know, it's not, it doesn't fall into that typical cliche. And then even at the end where his like ex-wife is, cause everyone's at the party, you know, he's come through it okay. And you know, everyone's alive and they're all celebrating and his ex-wife's there with her husband. And you get a sense like, you know, she really cared about him.
Mm-hmm.
And, but there's a sense of like, they're all at peace with each other, you know, it's kind of a nice little moment. He's not bitter and, you know, but she's not leaving her husband to go back with him or anything.
Like yeah.
That. But it all seems, you know, everyone's, you know, kind of reached a certain state of peace.
How awful would that be, that conversation be for the ex-wife and the new husband? It's like, well, you need to go to this party with me. My ex-husband's going to jump through the roof of this building. All right, that old thing. All right, let's go. You know, you have to dress up. We're going to take our daughter. She's going to fall asleep.
That's right.
The whole thing. We got to go through the tolls. It's going to take us 40 minutes to get home. It's just a whole deal they have to go through.
But we got to do it.
Yeah, we have to be there. We're a principal member. We have to
be there. I remember when I first, this just reminded me when I saw in the theater, and when he jumps off, mm-hmm. you know, and I keep thinking, okay, it's a Fincher film. This is where I thought we were going to get. When he hits and you see everyone there, you get like a glimpse of everyone there in tuxes, and you realize he's landed on a big, you know, the air mattress. And then you hear like the guys going like, that's fake glass, but it can still cut. And like everyone seems so concerned with him. It was like normally a movie has like a dark twist at the end, but this was such a happy twist. I was like really excited about it. I was like, I did not see that coming at all. I really liked the ending.
Yeah, I think that it definitely sticks it. I mean, it's definitely the most memorable part of the film. I think that you have this the rooftop scene. When you watch it a second time, I feel like it went on longer than I remember it going on.
Mm-hmm.
But you have the sort of reversal of, oh, they didn't know that he had. And I love that it's, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird. But,
right.
You know, it's the gun that they didn't find, and it's all very plausible.
Mm-hmm.
And you're watching it as an audience member going, oh my God, like, oh, don't do it. You know, don't do anything.
And, right. Like all the pieces are in place for like something very bad to happen.
Yes. And you think he shoots his brother and, you know, he amazingly gets down to the bottom of that building really quickly, by the
right,
way.
Right. It is pretty quick.
But, you know, they have that rooftop scene, and that's what I felt like after he gets shot. That's what I felt like when the end of Seven happened. And I'm like, oh man, like really, Fincher? Jesus.
It's dark.
Yeah. And then he jumps off the roof, and I'm like, oh my God. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, it makes sense. You know, it's just kind of, it's a little cliche that that's what his dad did too, but they'd sort of alluded to it and they'd made sure it was the same age. And I guess I can see that. And then when it's revealed that it's something different, I'm like, oh, well, that's clever. Like it's, and you're right. It is almost like an anti-Seven to where it's this twist, but it's a happy one.
It is. And I mean, I think, you know, at that, like in Seven, it's such a dark movie that twist is like a punch in the stomach at the end, but you're almost kind of, I don't know if you're wanting it, but this is kind of what it's been building to. And if it didn't go that far, you'd feel like it had pulled back for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
But in this movie, he's redeemed himself. You feel he's genuinely changed and you feel for him. So you really don't want that ending. You know, when he realized he's alive and that everyone was really watching out for him the whole time, I think it's what you wanted, even if you didn't realize that's what you wanted.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's well said. I really do like the way that that ends. And you don't see a lot of that. I mean, through your, you know, Shyamalan when he was
right.
A lot more well respected than he is now. I mean, it's usually the, the aghast, like, oh, everything wasn't what we thought, but it's in a negative way. Or
exactly, yeah. It's usually a twist, yeah, that takes everything darker. It's rarely a twist that is happier than you thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm. Unless you're a fan of Kevin Spacey and you're watching The Usual Suspects or something.
Yeah. Well, that's a pretty great twist.
Yes, it is.
Say like Kevin Spacey and Pay It Forward or something. Although I think that has a dark twist at the end.
I think I gave him the benefit of the doubt with K-Pax.
And then I never saw K-Pax.
And then when Pay It Forward came out, I was like, yeah, you're not fooling me again.
Yeah.
You're not fooling me.
Oh, Kevin.
Yeah. Boy, he makes some interesting choices.
Yeah, he definitely does.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of Seven, he insisted, I think, that his name not be in the opening credits and not be mentioned on the poster. Because, you know, when we saw Lisa in the theater, not knowing, when he shows up, you're like, is that Kevin Spacey? I mean, it was a complete surprise.
Yeah, I was completely unspoiled when I first saw that as well. So I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
What is he doing in here? You know? And I immediately think, like, did I just miss that? Because usually I'm paying attention, you know. So I don't know. So no, tell me more about this book. What is there anything else in there that you can think of that is worth noting? You know, in the other show that I do outside of Plain Label, the Filmographies show, we are going through William Friedkin.
Ah.
And
Friedkin. What are you on? I confess I haven't.
What's that?
Are you going through chronologically?
Yep, we'll go through chronologically. We just recorded on Cruising, the Deal of the Century. And
okay, yeah. I keep forgetting he directed that.
Yeah, and then To Live and Die in L.A.
Yeah, I love To Live and Die in L.A. I got to listen. You know, Cruising is such a fascinating movie because it's one of those movies where you're like, I can't believe this was made.
Yeah. We talked quite a bit about that and about how, you know, they kind of found the film in the editing room, supposedly, and Pacino wasn't pleased at all with the implications and didn't do any press for it and all this. But one of the things that was interesting that Cameron and I talked about was in Friedkin's, in his book.
I read that book, yeah.
He doesn't mention The Deal of the Century hardly at all.
Is that the one with Dudley Moore?
No, and like it's Eddie Chevy Irvington Chase.
It's Chevy Chase.
Chevy Chase and Gregory Hines and Sigourney Weaver.
Okay, that's
Sigourney Weaver thinking. Off of Alien, but before Ghostbusters.
That's right. Oh, okay.
And it's terrible.
I remember the ads from when I was a kid, but I've never seen it.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's sort of a spoof of like military overspending and. Kind of like The Lord of War with Nick Cage.
Oh yeah, with Nicolas Cage.
A little bit like that, but there's no jokes, and it's kind of like they started out with the comedy and then just quit telling jokes. It's not very good at all.
That's not good. And, I actually kind of liked. I always liked Gregory Hines as an actor.
Yeah, we kind of thought that with Chevy Chase's reputation and Friedkin's reputation that there would have at least been some sort of story in there.
Yeah,
but no,
neither of those guys are supposed to be that easy to get along with.
Yeah, we actually had Gabe Hardman on the episode before that. That'll be releasing as of we are recording. It'll be releasing Friday.
Okay.
But we talked about French Connection, The Exorcist, and Sorcerer.
I've never seen Sorcerer. I need to see.
It's an interesting movie. It's very American 70s.
Uh-huh. I like American 70s.
Yeah, me too. And it had the unfortunate timing of coming out the week after Star Wars hit.
Oh, well, that'll do it.
And just completely, the appetite was gone for those sort of films.
Yeah, that kind of a gritty, especially, that week right there.
Yeah, it was gritty and it's slow and it's long and you don't really know the characters all that well and everyone's kind of bummed out. And
that's with Roy Scheider's in there, right?
Yeah, Roy Scheider, yeah. We talked about his interesting career, too.
Yeah, he just has all that. Over I was place. Just watching Naked Lunch. I forgot he was in that.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Speaking of movies to talk to Vince about, holy cow. He loves that movie.
I like it okay, although it's not my favorite Cronenberg, but
I mean, if you had to imagine someone that would love that movie, wouldn't it be Vince, though?
Oh, of course. Oh, easily. Of course.
Yeah. So, yeah. So did you have any other tidbits about this, though? And you'll have to give me the name of this again, because I'm going to have to put it on my...
The book is called, let's see, it's called Dark Eye, The Films of David Fincher by James Swallow. Let's see, it came out. He's a British fellow because he dedicates it for Mum, Daddy, and Mandy.
Mm.
And it came out in 2003, which means it includes Panic Room.
Okay.
But it does not include anything else. And let's see, here are the movies they think he might be making. I don't think any of these... there's a movie called Vertig that he never made. Hard Boiled, I think. Oh, that's the Frank Miller comic book. Fincher was once attached to that.
Really?
Yeah. A biography of Herman Mankiewicz. Rendezvous with Rama, which is an Arthur C. Clarke novel. I've heard that. But, it doesn't look like... You know, and the thing is, it's like, what are they going to predict? That he was going to make The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo? Hadn't been written. Wasn't right. Going to make Social Network because Facebook didn't exist.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things I have on my Amazon list is The Greatest Films You'll Never See. And it has a lot of those sort of things where it's like, well, this guy was supposed to be with this, and here's what happened, and here's why it fell apart. And
well, and you know, Fincher is at this... He's being mentioned in a lot of these Sony emails that have been released because at one point, who was it? Producer Scott Rudin wanted him to direct Aaron Sorkin's script for the Steve Jobs story, but then Angelina Jolie wanted to try and get Fincher to direct this Cleopatra movie. And that's what a lot of these initial, some of the first emails they released were all about that.
Oh, about Angelina Jolie, right?
They all wanted Fincher. Because he, you know, he just made Gone Girl and, which I didn't think was a great movie, but it's, you know, it's as with all Fincher movies, it's definitely worth watching.
Yeah, I have, we have that. I think that's going to be, that'll be actually after this releases. So we either will or will have not done this. But in January, we're going to do what we missed for 2014. And so it'll be the films that came out in the theater and we just didn't get around to seeing. And so we're hoping that will be available by then.
They'll probably get it out.
It'll either be because we may make it into 2 months because there's going to be a lot of them. We're going to have a couple of guests. It'll be a whole thing. So I know that I want to see that. I want to see Whiplash. There's a bunch of.
I want to see Whiplash. I just saw Nightcrawler last week.
Oh yeah, that one's on there too.
I mean, it's a pretty good movie. I mean, it's a good movie. It's very well done. It's kind of a nice, streamlined, almost like a 70s feel kind of movie.
Mm-hmm.
But Gyllenhaal is
more of a performance than it is a movie, right?
Yeah, the movie's okay, but he's what's worth watching in it. He's great.
Yeah.
Just really
that's
great. Great in an interesting way too. I mean, it's a different performance.
Yeah. You know what I'm finding is that's interesting about this movie is the game has a lot of interesting things that happen to it and in it, but it is very much a just sit and watch it.
Yes, it's not a very deep movie.
Yeah, it's very plot heavy. So it's, you know, you could go by and be like, hey, what about this scene? Wasn't that cool? Yep, sure was.
Right, but like I mean,
but yeah, there's not like, a lot to dig into about it.
Right, like I mean, Seven, like the two movies that bookend it, Seven and Fight Club. You know, I mean, what, you know, I happen to like both a lot, but there's definitely some meat there that you can dig into and themes and, you know, this and that. You know, this is really more like Panic Room,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, kind of a sit and watch it kind of very entertaining, but it's, you know, it's just a thriller really. I mean, there's not a whole lot more to it than that.
Yeah. I do like how he kind of bounces back and forth between sort of his more, like he's saying something and then a fun
right.
action movie.
Yeah, like Social Network, I think I think it's really entertaining. I think it moves like lightning. But, you know, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is, though it has a lot of dark themes, it's really just a paperback thriller kind of movie.
Yeah. And, you know, unfortunately for me, I thought it was less successful than the original.
See, I've never seen the original movie.
Mm, okay.
I wonder if it's
a case of I saw it, and so the parts that are supposed to be shocking shocked me, And so
you mean you saw the Swedish one first?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then when I watched the Fincher version, I'm like, okay, well, they have to have this brutal rape, right? And they have to have the revenge, right? And
right.
And so it's like, well, okay, like, it does what it's supposed to, but if you've seen it, you're like, all right, well, this is coming, and it's going to be this guy at the end. And
I mean, when that movie came out, I remember some people, you know, people were like, well, those scenes were, you know, so awful, you know, and it's, and I was thinking, and this is certainly not to equate it with any sort of a real assault, but the movie needs those scenes. Those are the most interesting scenes, really, in the movie. I mean, that's when you really sit up and take notice. Mm-hmm. But they're kind of pulpy revenge scenes. You know, something horrible happens to her, and then she gets her revenge, and then, you know, it establishes something about the character. There's not a whole lot of meaning underneath that. I mean, that's just what it is.
You know, and what it reminds me of is we talk about The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo when we had our books to movies theme in the summer. And what it reminds me of is the original comes across as here, this actually happened. Here's the account of it.
Mm-hmm.
And this version's like, okay, here's Hollywood's account of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's very stylishly filmed.
Yeah, it's stylish. You have Rooney Mara who looks like she's just pretending instead of being the character.
Right.
Like she's playing dress up a little bit, it looks like to me. You know, and it's kind of like, oh no, I'm not, this is for real. I'm really getting down and getting to it. And it's like that, you know, sort of Tropic Thunder of it all. Towards you're full of shit. You know, and I am hopeful that he actually doesn't do The Girl Who Played with Fire, even though he is announced to be attached to that.
I don't know if he's, I mean, I don't, I think that it was, I think the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was, I mean, a kind of a disappointment box office wise. I don't think anyone's dying for the sequel.
Yeah. I think he probably, they probably did some sort of option.
Right.
You know, like you have to, you kind of sign on to the franchise, and if it hits, you know, we'll do the second one kind of a thing. Cause the next two, I mean, the last two are even more of just kind of your airport novel.
Really?
Yeah, I mean they're less substantial. It's just her going around and fucking with people. You know, so it's not I don't know. I mean the book supposedly isn't that deep, and the films aren't that deep. It's surprising to me that it was such a success, the series in general, to where it's had, you know, four movies now.
Yeah, I mean
the three originals in this one.
That's crazy. Now, did you see Gone Girl?
No, not yet.
I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I get, you know, there's a lot, I mean, you see a lot of op-ed pieces on, you know, what this means for marriage and this and that. But I mean, essentially at its heart, it's an airport novel too. I mean, and it feels like one. It's fine, but it's not like a movie for our times or anything.
Well, it's too bad. I mean, you know, cause I thought that The Social Network was fine, but I wasn't really crazy about it. You know, I mean, I liked the movie, but it wouldn't, it's not one I would run out and buy, for me. So, I guess I need to rewatch Zodiac because I know everyone loves it.
I love Zodiac.
But I was kind of lukewarm about that too. So I was like, I don't know. Like, do I just not like David Fincher anymore?
Or? You know, maybe you don't. I mean,
maybe.
There's his movies do have a certain, you know, chilliness about them. I mean, there's.
Yeah, and see, what's interesting about that is like that's the sort of rap on Chris Nolan is that he's makes detached films, right?
Right.
But I tend to like him, and Kubrick is sort of the father of that.
Oh, yeah, and I love Kubrick.
Yeah, I love the ones, you know, Ben and I have been practically going through his filmography with the films that we're doing. I think each time we pick a new movie, he's like, well, how about another Kubrick? I'm like, ah.
Well, you know, and people, the Coen brothers get that rap too. That they don't care about their characters, and everything is sort of one step removed.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I like a movie you can get emotionally involved in, but I prefer a little distance rather than just, you know, wallowing in every, you know, draining every possible.
Than doing a Ron Howard, Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, I mean, and I like the Spielberg emotion stuff, but there's, you know, it's that end of Schindler's List when Liam Neeson is talking about all the money you wasted. You're like, stop, you didn't need this scene, leave this out, you know, I mean.
Yeah, you know, we recorded not too long ago on AI, And that's
you need to watch that again.
Yeah, that's a movie to where I hope people do listen to that and rewatch it, because it is so much more than what I thought it was when I watched it and just kind of took it at first glance. And with the rewatch, I was like, wow, I really like this movie. And it is overstuffed and there are problems with it. But I think that it's, when it hits, it hits really hard. And I think that it's really effective in points.
I remember that scene where the mom is like making him get out of the car. She's going to abandon him. That's a hard scene.
Yeah. And that's hard when he holds on to the brother and doesn't let go and goes to the bottom of the pool.
Yeah.
That's tough.
It's, you know what movies, I mean, and this is, I'm going to sound crazy when I say this, but I watched E.T. with my wife and daughter for the first time, a couple months ago, for the first time, probably in like, I don't know, 30 years maybe? I mean, since it was like first on videotape, and that held up a lot better than I thought it would. I mean, it definitely is, you know, tear-jerking in parts, but it also has this kind of weird, still like a 70s paranoia about it. Like,
well, yeah, I think that the most effective part of it is when you don't see any adults besides the mom.
That's just what I was going to say. It's the whole, most of the movie, you don't see any adult faces except for the mom at all.
Mm.
And it's, you know, and it's dark. It's a darker film. I mean, visually darker than I think a lot of people remember. It's an interesting movie.
Yeah. We get to the second half and it falls apart a little bit for me.
Yeah.
I think I'm like, oh, it's a little schmaltzy and it's a little of this and a little of that. You know, you're hitting on all the right wavelengths, because we just talked about E.T. not too long ago for our childhood favorites as well.
Yeah.
So there you go.
And I remember, I mean, you know, and that was, you know, that movie was after, I think it was, that took the crown from Star Wars as the most popular movie in the world for a while, the box office champ, and held it until Jurassic Park, maybe?
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, it was a while.
Yeah. That's crazy, because, you know, we watched, when we watched E.T., we watched it with Anna, and she's watching it, and we had this discussion about Ratatouille, and she had said that it must be the extended part of the movie, because she didn't remember it.
Uh-huh.
And so we were watching E.T., and I was trying to tell her, I was like, well, this is the extended version, and E.T. dies at the end of this one. And she's like, no, he doesn't. And I was like, yeah, he dies. And then so it kind of got her out of this, oh, I know what's going to happen.
Right.
I've seen this before. And so for that little bit, you know, she's watching it a little bit more intently. Then she gives me the, oh, I knew it, you know, all that stuff. But that's kind of fun. I mean, that's what being a parent's about, right? It's messing with them.
We watched Pee-wee's Big Adventure with my daughter, and she had never seen it. And that movie, by the way, holds up beautifully. I
love the gum. I love the crazy road signs.
It's all good. I mean, it really plays well. It's funny all the way through. There's very few slow parts. But we're watching, and we get to the large barge scene, and I start watching Allie because she has no idea what's coming. And it freaked her out.
Yeah, I can imagine so.
And I said, she was like, ah, and I said, do you want to watch it again? She's like, no. I said, look, if you watch it again, you'll see. It's really funny. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, you think it's scary, but it's not.
Yeah.
But, you know.
that's the benefits right there, is doing stuff like that, right?
Oh, I know. And I saw, I remember seeing that in the theater when it opened, and the whole audience reacted like that, because nobody saw that coming.
Sure. Yeah, that is good. I remember watching that a lot when I was younger.
And that was one of the holdovers I had from when I reviewed movies for the newspaper. So they sent me the Blu-ray, and it looks great on Blu-ray.
Really?
It's so colorful, and everything just pops. I mean, it looks really good.
I'm going to have to get that on my queue.
Yeah, it's worth checking out.
There you go. Well, do you have anything else about the game before we wrap this one up, Will?
I was trying to find that quote, and I cannot find it in this book. I know it's in here, and I also know it's in the liner notes of the Criterion Blu-ray that I was reading. But yeah, it's basically saying that it's a movie, but the main character refuses to act according to the script, which is what's kind of interesting. They set up this whole premise, but then they put Michael Douglas in it, playing a Michael Douglas character. And, of course, he has no patience for any of this. But then in the end, he learns to have a little patience. So it's,
yeah,
you know,
I do like that little bit where they talk about how that was the best one ever. And
Right.
You know, it makes me think, like, a lot of these guys just kind of shrivel up and are no fun. Mm-hmm. You know, when they try to play these different games.
He was a challenge. I love the fact that, and maybe this is why, one reason I love that the lunchroom scene so much is they really, when you watch this movie, you find yourself imagining the other games going on in other places. They really make this seem like it's this, you know, that these guys do this all over and they play different roles. And this isn't like something mysterious to them. It's just a job.
Yeah.
And to me, that makes it, you know, rather than being like an evil conspiracy, that would have been dumb. But it's so much more interesting. It's just this company. It's exactly what it says it is. It's a recreation company.
Yeah. Because I like how she's talking about going down to Australia and she just has a walk-on role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's perfect. I mean, and, you know, I'm sure the actors, you know, it reads, when you think about it, it really does read like a movie. You know, they're making a movie, just not in the form of a movie. Mm-hmm. And the star doesn't know he's in the movie.
Yeah, I like that. I do like that. All right, well, if you have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about specifically for Podshots, you could email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You could follow the show over at Twitter under the handle @plainlabelpod, where you could follow me. I'm @ericwilliams79. We also have a Facebook page for the show. You could like it. Just search for Plain Label Podcast. If you wanted to help us out a little bit, you could head over to Amazon.com and search for our wish list. It's full of the movies we want, the equipment that we need, and a whole host of other goodies. If you're in the giving mood, just search for Plain Label Podcast, and you will notice that I did put the David Fincher book that Will was talking about on there, because I think that sounds interesting. So I do want to thank...
You know, great book, but if you like Fincher, it's a detailed examination of his first four or five movies.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It'll be interesting just for the whole how it all began sort of thing, I would imagine.
And it gives, you know, a lot of production details and a lot of trivia. So
there you go.
It's not a bad book.
Yeah, so I do want to thank Will for coming on and talking about the film with me. If people wanted to hear more from you, they could check out our previous discussion back in the archive of The Iron Giant.
That's right.
But if people wanted to hear more from you specifically, or maybe they wanted to buy some of your comic books, where could they get in contact with you?
Well, they can follow me on Twitter @WillPfeiffer. That's WILLPFEIFER. You can follow me on Facebook. I have a blog that I update semi-frequently called xrayspecs.blogspot.com. That's xrayspex. And I'm currently writing Teen Titans for DC, and the issue number 5 just hit store, so it should be at your local comic book shop.
Well, there you go. There you go. What was November's movies that you watched?
What did I watch? I watched a lot in November, more than I thought. I saw Interstellar. I saw...
What did you think of Interstellar?
I liked it. You know, I don't know if I was blown away by it. I mean, you kind of go into a movie like that and you just hope that it's just going to, you know, overwhelm you. But I liked it. I like Chris Nolan. The smart movies. You know, he's swinging for the fences. I mean,
yes.
He's really trying something different.
I do like that. I do like that it wasn't real safe.
No. And at the end, without spoiling anything, I was thinking, like, is he really going to go with, like, kind of a love conquers all thing? And he doesn't really. I mean, it sort of does, but there's more to it than that.
Yeah.
Which I was relieved at. But I liked it. And as, you know, I thought they handled the father-daughter connection really well. I thought that was kind of a nice touch. So
the McConaissance.
Of course, it looked great.
Yeah, and the McConaissance is in full swing, right?
Oh, yeah. And McConaissance, he's amazing. He was great on True Detective and Wolf. I saw Birdman.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I saw that too.
That is not what I was – I liked it a lot, but it was not at all what I was expecting.
I was so – like it took me probably three-fourths of the movie to figure out that I had no idea what I was watching.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, wow, this is so weird compared to what I thought it was going to be.
You know what? It really is. I mean, if you are a fan of theater – it's a backstage movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it more so than I thought it was going to be.
You know, and I've watched all of Inarritu's other films, and I was like, this is nothing like...
No, it's nothing like...
Because I came into it thinking, oh, okay, it's Amores Perros, like, I know what I'm in for.
Right, yeah. You 21 know, Grams, like, you kind of have, yeah.
Yeah, we've done 21 Grams on here, and that, I mean, talk about a depressing-ass movie, so I was like, okay, yeah. Michael Keaton playing this former washed-up star, like, this is going to be great, and it was... you know, with the score and everything, it was just so very different from what I thought.
It's such an unusual movie, and the way it's filmed, you know, it's essentially, I mean, it's not really, but they make it look like it's, you know, one take essentially, even though it goes over a period of days.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and yeah, it's something else. I mean, it's one you really come out of the theater and you're kind of chewing on for a while.
Yeah, I hear you.
It's good.
All right. Well, thank you for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with another co-host and another film.
Thank you.